Well, I'm not sure if you've seen that clip before, but it's from the movie Up. I first saw it last summer. I took our three oldest kids to the movies. Our youngest daughter, Rachel, was too young to go, and so I left her at home with Ilona. And I'm not sure I've ever wanted to hold my wife's hand as much as watching that scene and just thinking about, this is what marriage is supposed to look like. This is a lifelong commitment that you get to share and enjoy together. And I think it's a powerful piece. It really beautifully illustrates what a lifetime of oneness looks like. So I entitled this final session, Persevering to Preserve Your Priceless Treasure. Now, we've looked at different aspects of what it takes to have a marriage that really is a priceless treasure. But I'm not sure that any of those things are as critical as the discipline of perseverance in marriage. A young man was traveling on an airplane when the man seated next to him started to make some polite conversation. He said, "Are you traveling on business or pleasure?" "Pleasure," the young man answered. "Actually, we're just coming back from our honeymoon." And the man sort of looked around and said, "Well, you know, where is your wife?" He said, "Well, the plane was crowded. We couldn't get seats together, so she is a few rows back, and we had to sit separately." So the man said, "Well, you know what? I'm going to give up my seat. Where's your wife? I'll tell her she can come here." He says, "Oh, no, please don't do that. We have been together all week, and I could really use the break." That's going to be some perseverance required, I would think, if you're in that situation. So he was probably wondering what he had signed himself up for. "Till death do us part" can seem like a very long time. Now, we've all heard of couples who just seem to get better with age, and we think about, you know, marriages that just kind of grow together and become stronger together as time goes on. We've all seen these couples who are in their 70s or 80s. They're still holding hands on the beach, and we all say, "I mean, that's what I want. I want a relationship that looks like that." Reminded of the couple who had been married a very long time, and the wife one night, they had celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary, and the wife was lying in bed next to her husband that night, and she started to reminisce, and she looked over at her husband and said, "Do you remember the way you used to hold my hand?" And the husband just kind of reached across and took hold of his wife's hand, gave her a little squeeze, and she said, "And do you remember how when we were first married, we used to snuggle so close together?" And so he kind of moved over a little bit, put his arm around her, and snuggled close into her. And she said she was in a particularly romantic mood that night, and she said, "And do you remember how you used to whisper sweet nothings into my ear? Do you remember how you would nibble on my earlobes?" And at that, the gentleman got out of bed and started walking away, and his wife said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to get my false teeth." That's the place we all want to be when we hit 50 years, right? We still want to be in that romantic place where there is this love that exists, this bond that exists, and it is stronger than ever. But the truth is, just making it to 50 years or to that kind of relationship can be a tremendous challenge. I remember hearing Howard Hendricks speak at a pastor's conference one time, and he was talking about his marriage and announced that he and his wife had been married for 40 years and they had never once contemplated divorce. Murder, yes, but divorce, never. Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" He answered, "Have you not read that he who created them at the beginning made them male and female and said, 'Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife and they shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate.' They said to him, 'Why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to send her away?' He said to them, 'Because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery.'" Jesus takes this teaching from Genesis chapter 2 and he applies it to this whole realm and this answering this question about divorce. Now again, you don't have to be on the verge of a divorce to benefit from what Jesus is teaching us here. Jesus takes the teaching of Genesis 2 and he adds to it by saying, "Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate." Now, we are familiar with what Jesus says. But obviously, this teaching is a challenge, and it's not just a challenge in our day. Look at the response of the disciples in verse 10. The disciples said to him, "If such is the case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry." Now, before we dismiss the response of the disciples as stupidity, we should remember that they were not the first or the last people to reach that conclusion. It is difficult. Jesus teaches us that. It's difficult to remain one for your entire life. Lifelong oneness is a challenge. And I want to say a couple things about how to meet this challenge of lifelong oneness. The first thing to do is to recognize the challenge, or the challenges. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but some of the challenges to lifelong oneness are actually more difficult today than they were in the past. Now, one of those challenges is the simple fact that life expectancy has increased greatly. Previous generations simply didn't live as long as we do today. John Calvin's wife died before their 10th wedding anniversary. Women often died in childbirth, and it was rare for a husband to still be alive when the youngest of the children left home. That's not in that far of the distant past. In 1911, the average length of marriage was 28 years. By 1967, it had risen to 42 years. A marriage that lasted 6 or 7 decades was pretty much unheard of. I know it sounds a little crazy, but till death do us part was a little bit easier simply because death came much sooner than it does today. In a marriage of 50 or 60 or 70 years, do you realize how long that is? I mean, think of that. You've heard absolutely every story your spouse has to tell. You know exactly what they're thinking, what they're going to say. I think another thing that makes this more difficult today is that divorce is so much easier today. In past generations, getting a divorce was a huge deal. Even 50 years ago, you had to actually prove to the state that you had legitimate grounds to separate what God had joined together. There was also enormous cultural pressure from family and friends for you to stay together as a couple. Today, getting a divorce is relatively easy. I was in Staples the other day and I saw a do-it-yourself divorce kit. I'm not making that up. But I mean, this is what we've come to. I need some tax software, a couple mechanical pencils, and might as well get one of those divorce kits. I mean, we are a generation of quitters. William Bennett was a political advisor who served under both Ronald Reagan and George Bush, the first one. And he tells the story of attending a wedding where the bride and groom committed to uphold their vows for as long as this love shall last. He said he sent paper plates as a wedding present. I mean, today it's almost more surprising to have a couple make it to their 50th wedding anniversary than it is to see them divorce. Look around the city and you will find everywhere divorce is common. Very difficult to make it to lifelong oneness. Now, all of those things are contributing factors in terms of what makes oneness so difficult. Why so many people separate what God has joined together. But I think there's a much more significant factor and a greater challenge that threatens oneness. One of the questions that I always ask our couples in marriage preparation is, do you know what the two greatest challenges to your marriage are? I get feedback from the couples heading towards marriage, and most of them say, well, it's got to be communication. or finances or interference from in-laws or something along those lines. None of those things are the right answer. The two biggest challenges, obstacles in your marriage are the husband and the wife. And that's not a joke. This is what Jesus says here. He permitted divorce because of the hardness of your hearts. Jesus is correcting the Pharisees here. They said, well, why did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce? And Jesus makes it clear. Moses never commanded it. He allowed it because of the hardness of people's hearts. Now, that's not the way we normally talk about divorce. Even in the church, we talk about falling out of love as though it's just kind of accidental. It just sort of happened. You know, we fall into love the way we fall into a pool. I think Gary Thomas has a wonderful way of putting things, and I like what he says when he says that when two Christians say they have fallen out of love, what they are really saying is they have fallen out of repentance. You see, whatever other challenges we might face in marriage, the biggest challenge we face will be the hardness of our own hearts. And when you recognize the hardness of your own heart, it will revolutionize the way you approach conflict with your spouse. In reality, it will affect the way you approach everything in your marriage because you start from the understanding, I have a hard heart and I need God to soften it and to break it down and to help me love my wife the way I'm supposed to. So the first thing you need to do is to recognize the challenges. The second thing you need to do is to understand the solution. And the solution, in a word, is perseverance. I realize this is not the sexiest answer to the question of what it takes to have a great marriage, but it's the biblical answer. We're all familiar with Paul's description of love in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Love is patient, love is kind, and on he goes. But in verse 7 of that chapter, Paul says, love endures all things. The NIV translates that as love always perseveres. And that's why the traditional wedding vows are surely right when they say for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. You will never keep your wedding vows without perseverance. Now, I know even in this group, people are at all different stages. Some of you have been married a number of years. I've talked to you. Some of you are heading towards marriage or you're just about to get married. But I don't think it really matters what stage you're at in your relationship or how long you've been married. One of the greatest needs in your marriage is for you to develop the discipline of perseverance. So just kind of want to walk you through what statistics tell us in terms of the three great seasons of challenge in any marriage. And I want to address each of those seasons separately because I think your own marriage, even if not now, it will fall into those seasons at some point. The first great challenge to marriage comes just after the honeymoon, or maybe even on the honeymoon. I remember the very first fight that Ilona and I had. It was on our honeymoon. We had rented a condo on Maui, and there was a shuffleboard deck at the back. And we had barbecued, and we said, hey, let's play some shuffleboard. This should be fun. And she beat me like four times in a row. And I was so ticked off. I mean, this had to be beginner's luck. I don't like to lose anything. And we got into a massive argument that night because of the hardness of my heart. And it was one of these realizations for me personally of just how petty and small-minded I can be when things don't go my way. And it was also a time for her to realize just how petty and small-minded I can be when things don't go my way. Now, it wasn't like we were contemplating divorce or anything like that. I knew with a bit of practice I could beat her the next day and everything would be fine. Just a realization there would be some bumps along the way. And that most of those bumps will be the result of the fact that two sinners have married each other. And this is what you can expect. I know the title of your day was, What Did You Expect? Redeeming the Realities of Marriage. The reality of marriage is that it's difficult at times. There's going to be some seasons where you just have to persevere. Now, again, some of you might have just been married a short time, and you may have already experienced some disillusionment in your marriage and some disillusionment with your spouse. I've had couples in my office literally less than 3 months into their marriage who've said, you know what, this is not what I signed up for. We want to call it quits. That's not exactly perseverance. See, what you need is not a new marriage or a new spouse, but a commitment to persevere through the tough times. Studies show that it takes between 9 and 14 years for a couple really to achieve a genuine sense of oneness together. Because until that time, you haven't really gone through the hard times together. You haven't really experienced life together. And couples who pack it in after just a few years are like people who only climb halfway up the mountain. They've done all the hard work, but they don't get the view. Giving up after just a few years of marriage because it's difficult is like saying, I hated junior high. I'm going to go back and do it all over again. Why would you do that? And yet this is what people do in marriage all the time. This is why most second marriages end in divorce. They've got to go through all the difficult stuff again. So the first great challenge to your marriage comes after the honeymoon. The second one comes when you have young children. Again, if this is future for you, my apologies. Please tuck this away in your memory. And when you've got young kids, maybe call it to mind. But those of you who have been there and those of you who are there now know this is true. Your relationship changes in so many ways when kids come along. Even before the kids come, things start to change. Physical intimacy tends to wane a little bit during the third trimester of pregnancy. And once the baby arrives, it wanes even more for a while. And so husbands will sometimes resent the fact that their wives aren't as available for them. And wives resent the fact that their husband's need for intimacy doesn't diminish. So there's a waning in this whole aspect of our marriages. But it's not just the level of intimacy that changes. Having kids is exhausting, especially once you have a few of them running around. And statistics tell us that marriages are at their most fragile state when they have young children. But this is actually the time they need to be at their strongest. Now, the solution is not to make a decision not to have kids, but to understand that this will be a season of marriage that will require perseverance. You're going to have to put some effort in and say, you know what? We got to persevere through this time. We need to just put our relationship, put a priority on that and make sure we keep it strong. So the first great challenge occurs just after the honeymoon. The second one comes when you have young children. The third one comes when your children leave home. Now, I know this is very future for a lot of you, but I think it's just worth thinking about this. This is kind of a recent phenomenon. But it's amazing how many couples will call it quits after 20 plus years of marriage. Reminds me of the couple in their 90s who announced that after 70 plus years of marriage, they were getting a divorce. And those who knew them were puzzled by their decision. Someone asked the husband, why would you throw away more than 7 decades of life together? He replied, well, you know, to be honest, the last few years really haven't been that good. We've just been waiting for the last of the kids to die. Now, again, this idea of being empty nesters is kind of a new phenomenon in our day. But this is the fastest statistically growing stage where divorces are taking place. Is now when kids leave the home. I watched this happen with some of our neighbors. People get to that place. They've spent all their time, their energy investing in their kids. Their kids leave the home. They look at each other. They say, who are you? What was it we had in common back then anyway? Because it's certainly not here now. And it's going to take some work to kind of persevere through that time. Now, I'm not trying to paint a doom and gloom picture. I mean, I know I've kind of done that a little bit. But I just want to give you some reality. There's going to be perseverance that is required in your life. Also, you know, you may dream, even couples that are kind of getting close to that point, start dreaming of their retirement years. But it may not look like you planned. Love can be tested in other ways. You watched in this clip from the movie Up how health can come into play in a marriage. When we say for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, we need to understand those things might happen. It might not be better. We might not have health. We might not have riches. We need to just keep this commitment to persevere, to love one another through all of those times. I want you to listen to the words that come from the resignation speech of Robertson McQuilkin. Robertson McQuilkin was the president of Columbia Bible College and Seminary in South Carolina from 1968 to 1990. In the 1980s, it became evident that his wife Muriel was in the early stages of Alzheimer. And in 1990, Robertson McQuilkin resigned from his position of president to care for his wife full time. This is what he said as he stood before the students and faculty. He said, "I haven't in my life experienced easy decision making on major decisions. But one of the simplest and clearest decisions I've had to make is this one, because circumstances dictated it. Muriel now in the last couple months seems to be almost happy when with me and almost never happy when not with me. In fact, she seems to feel so trapped, becomes very fearful, almost terror-like, and when she can't get to me, there can be anger. She's in distress. But when I am with her, she's happy and contented, and so I must be with her at all times. And you see, it's not only that I promised in sickness and in health, till death do us part, and I am a man of my word, but as I have said, I don't know with this group, but as I have said publicly, it's the only fair thing. She sacrificed for me for 40 years to make my life possible. So if I cared for her for 40 years, I would still be in her debt. However, there is much more. It's not that I have to, it's that I get to. I love her very dearly, and you can tell it's not easy to talk about. She is a delight, and it's a great honor to care for such a wonderful woman." See, that's what lifelong oneness might look like. There might be periods of failing health and having to look after one another, and that's what you're called to as a husband and as a wife. Robertson McQuilkin cared for his wife until she died 13 years later. See, this is what we're committing ourselves to when we stand before our family and our friends and our God and we say, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. Is that the commitment? Those of you heading towards marriage, do you understand the significance of that commitment? It's a huge calling. The solution is not a change in our circumstances, but a change in our heart, in a commitment to persevere. I said we need to recognize the challenges. We need to understand the solution. Let me just give you one final thing. And that is to say that we need to continually reflect on Christ's love for us. I don't want you to think of this as something extra that you do. This should be the thing that gives us motivation for what we're called to. So just like Jesus, the Apostle Paul went back to Genesis chapter 2 when he wanted to instruct us about what marriage is supposed to look like. I read this earlier, but I'm going to read it again. I'm going to read Ephesians 5, 25 to 32. "Husbands, love your wives, as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church." Paul says that our marriages are supposed to be reflections of the relationship between Christ and his church. We're actually exhorted this way a number of times in the New Testament. When it comes to outsiders, we are told to welcome them because Christ has welcomed us. When it comes to forgiveness, we are told to forgive one another as the Lord has forgiven us. And when it comes to love, we are told to love one another the way Christ has loved us. I think as we reflect on the sacrificial nature of Christ's love for us, it helps us better understand the kind of sacrificial love we are called to in our marriages. I want to just give you an example of sacrificial love that might help. This is from Brian Chappell. He's from Covenant Seminary. He says, an example of such sacrificial love surfaced a few years ago in my hometown when two brothers decided to play on the sandbanks by the river's edge. Because our town depends on the river for commerce, dredges regularly clear its channels of sand and deposit it in great mounds beside the river. Few things are more fun for children than playing on these mountainous sand piles, and few things are more dangerous. While the sand is still wet from the river's bottom, the dredges dump it on the shore, the piles of dry sand with rigid crusts, dry with rigid crusts that often conceal cavernous internal voids formed by the escaping water. If a child climbs on a mound of sand that has hidden such a void, the external surface easily collapses. Sand from higher on the mound then rushes into the void, trapping the child in a sinkhole of loose sand. This is exactly what happened to the two brothers as they raced up one of the larger mounds. When the boys did not return home at dinner time, family and neighbors organized a search. They found the younger brother. Only his head and shoulders protruded from the mound. He was unconscious from the pressure of sand on his body. The searchers began digging frantically. When they had cleared the sand to his waist, he roused to consciousness. "Where is your brother?" the rescuers shouted. "I'm standing on his shoulders," replied the child. With the sacrifice of his own life, the older brother gave it for his younger brother. With the sacrifice of his life, Christ gave his life for the church. And we are called to give our lives for one another in marriage. It is an incredible calling that we're given. We need to be committed to sacrifice for one another. And the thing that ought to give us motivation is to remember the depths that Christ went to sacrifice for us. I'm going to pray. And then, again, if there are questions, comments, we'll take those after. Father, as we think about marriage, we are reminded that it is your institution. It's your idea that you have designed it, that you know how it's supposed to function, that we should take our cues from what your word tells us. Lord, as we look at the state of marriage in our own day, the state of divorce, we know that this is not an easy thing. That if left to our own power, our own devices, we would not make it. And so, God, we pray for your strength and your power. We pray that you would give us the mind of Christ, that we would have that kind of sacrificial outlook for our spouses. We commit ourselves to you. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, I'm going to just... I know there hasn't been a lot of questions or comments so far. I'm not sure that there are any, but are there anything you guys want to talk about? I'm happy to do that. So fire away. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if there's any additional learning or tool resources that you recommend?
Yeah, you know, I would say if you're already married, I mean, I'd be reading some solid books on this. This book I just read from is called Each for the Other. It's basically just an exposition of Ephesians chapter 5 by Brian Chappell and his wife, Kathy. Good marriage resource. As couples heading towards marriage, I would also say find some good resources that you can go through together to help build your marriage and make it strong. Some recommended ones that I think are really helpful. Gary Thomas, who I referred to a couple times, his book Sacred Marriage gives you not the how-tos of, you know, fights over toothpaste, but the big picture. What is it that God had in mind in our marriages? Those are two books I would recommend, as well as the one I mentioned from C.J. Mahaney. sex, romance, and the glory of God.
Just in addition to that, I'd like to say that books are great, but having a mentor is is great. And Jen's parents were a fabulous model for us, but small group leaders, having people who've been down the road.
Yeah.
There's so many bad examples of what it means to be married, and there's a lot of traps that are waiting for you. So having somebody you can say, okay, well, you've already been through this, you've gone through this road, and can help pull you through it.
Absolutely. This is a fantastic point. If you don't have, I know in our church, if you're getting married, we always pair people up with a mentor couple. The teaching is important, but really that mentor relationship we see as the thing of most importance. And a lot of people didn't have this modeled for them in their homes. So my wife and I are prime examples. Neither of us were Christians growing up, didn't know what a Christ-like marriage looked like. So in some ways, we kind of had low expectations, which maybe was a good thing. Because everything exceeded our expectations, right? But we had couples that we looked to. We joined a Bible study. Everyone was 10 to 15 years older than us. We watched the way they interacted with each other, the way they raised their kids, and we identified people that we said, that's the kind of marriage we want to have. That's the kind of family we want to emulate. So look for those examples in your church. Find them. They're around.
I'm just thinking about, like, those of us who marriage is in, like, the distant future.
Yeah.
like, it's hard, you know, like, when you're trying to pursue your relationship with God at the same time the other person. I'm just, like, wondering if you could talk about, like, when you're having, like, different convictions than the other person and you're trying to, you know, you want to make sure that you are only dependent on God first or the other person.
Yeah.
And how do you balance that?
Okay. Great question. So the first thing I'd say is absolutely put a priority on your relationship with God. Make sure you find your security in your relationship with God first before in your partner. I think that's the first thing. Be strong there and don't be so easily swayed or dependent on someone else and what their spiritual life is like. The second thing, though, is I think make this a part of your conversation. I mean, talk about what your beliefs are and your convictions on things. Having differing convictions may or may not be a big issue. If they're around essentials of the faith, it's a big issue. If they're around, you know, peripheral things, it's not. But again, maybe finding that sort of, even an individual mentor who you can talk to, who's a little bit older, more seasoned, who can speak into your life and say, you know, this is what I observe in you. Being open to that kind of criticism. The danger I see a lot of couples make, I ran our college ministry for 4 years and have taught marriage prep for the last 8 years or so. One huge mistake I see couples make is they become very isolated. They turn inwards to each other and the rest of the world could not exist for all they care. And they lose that insight from other people. They don't allow anyone to speak into their life. They perceive that all as a threat. You should welcome feedback from close friends and from those who are a little bit more senior than you are. Ask those kind of questions. Find out from couples, you know, around the spiritual life. Find out what do couples do to maintain a spiritual life in their marriage. What does that look like? Find ministry opportunities that you can serve together. So you can say, boy, I've seen my potential spouse in this environment. I've seen how they are with kids. You learn a lot in those kind of situations. So I think time is always your greatest ally in the dating kind of courting period. Great questions.
You just mentioned isolation. Are there any other common pitfalls that you've seen in your counseling and in your ministry for marriages in the first few years?
Okay, so for let me just say a couple things around just things I see all the time. For those not married, first, I see a huge pull. I talk to couples all the time who, you know, they've got their Christian convictions, but they get together with someone who's not a believer, and that eventually has a pull in their life and does pull them away. For couples who are married, pitfalls in their first few years of marriage, the isolation, I think, is one thing. They kind of pull back from the church. You know what? We need to kind of do some stuff together. They're not there on a regular basis. They don't have people speaking into their life, so that's one thing. I think the other thing is kind of keeping their problems completely to themselves. It is normal to have some challenges in the early stages of your relationship. And a lot of couples, I mean, everyone wants to ask, you know, how's it going? And you can just kind of keep the good face on and say, everything's fine. If there are some problems, you need to address them right away. Go to your pastor, talk to somebody about it and say, hey, here's some stuff we're dealing with. What you may find is this is just normal. Every couple goes through this. Or you may find there's a bigger issue going on here. And if we don't kind of root it out now, it'll fester and build and it'll end somewhere. It'll come out. So, yeah, great question, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you give some examples of what that looks like as opposed to what you're talking about before?
With interfering? Sure. Okay. So, I mean, I'd say a couple things. One is, I think it's very different if you seek that out. If you have a couple that you look to, admire, and you say, you know, I value these people and they seem to possess wisdom. I want some wisdom from them. That's one thing. When you're seeking it out, even if it hurts, you're going to take that maybe better. Proverbs says wounds from a friend can be trusted, right? So even if they hurt you by what they say, you should be able to take that and say, okay, I'm willing to assess that honestly. What I was talking about earlier, having people interfere with your relationship, I think what I was talking about is partly parents can do that. They can control purse strings. Like you get involved financially with your parents and you may find yourself in some difficulty because, yeah, they've given this money, but there are some strings attached to it and they would not like you to make that decision, but this decision. So there's a lot of control that can go on. In terms of other people, what I was talking about was a situation where, you know, instead of talking to your spouse, you confide in your best friend. And your best friend's not the biggest fan of your husband anyway. And it's not helping you make your marriage stronger. It's actually doing the opposite. So part of it is who's doing the counseling. What kind of values do they have? If they have your best interest at heart, it makes a huge difference than something else. So seeking out the right kind of people, I think, is really key. Scott.
What does a healthy decision-making process look like?
That's a great question, because this comes up in the whole area of leadership and submission and all of that stuff. Again, I said it's often misunderstood, and I think it is, because for some people, it's... Yeah, I've talked to some couples, and they're like, well, this means, you know, can't seem to reach a decision. Then I pull out the card that says, I'm the head, and that's what we're doing. I think people are really foolish if they don't make decisions together. So if it's a life decision, you ought to consult with your wife and talk about these things together. First thing, I think you ought to pray about it. I think you ought to talk to others around you. Hey, do you think this is a good decision for us? You know, we're looking at making this move. We're looking at taking a job in another city. Do you see this as a good thing for us? So find trusted people, again, you can talk to. And then the two of you sitting together talking about what's going to be the impact. If we go down this road, what's this going to look like for us? What does this mean for our family? Those sorts of things, talking together and praying about it together, I think are big advantages in making decisions. But the idea of, I'm just going to put my foot down on this one, typically I don't see that going too well. You know, I'll just give you some examples. As a in my own situation, I've had some calls, whatever, to go to another church or be part of something. And even if it's attractive to me, I think it's very important that my wife would be excited about that type of opportunity, that I'm not just kind of charging headlong into something because this is what I want to do. And you might just say, well, you know, I mean, leadership is just taking that road. You have to be very sensitive to how this is going to impact your spouse. So even around where to live, this is an issue we went through as a couple. My wife is at home with our kids. And so in reality, I feel like I could live anywhere in the city. It was more important for her to be close to her family. And so that's weighs huge in my decision-making around that stuff. So that's why we live where we live. We live a block from her sister, and that's important. And I am more than happy. She's the one that's home all day. So I'm more than happy for her to do that and to live. Well, we live in White Rock, so there's no complaining about it anyway. But those kind of things, factor in your spouse's feelings, by all means. And when you both start with that joint idea of let's make the best decision, what God would want us to do, very seldom are you going to get into an impasse, I think, in those types of situations.
Just continuing on with the whole leadership submission thing, are there certain ways during the sort of dating, courting phase that those things you can start to learn?
Yeah. One, I would say that a lot of guys are intimidated. They know this, right? Like there's this teaching. We're supposed to be leaders and spiritual leaders in our homes. But for a lot of men, they're like, I don't know exactly how to do that. So for guys, I would say you have to start somewhere. So start where you are. Start trying to initiate and take some leadership in those things. For women, I would say encourage as they try and do that. Support what they're trying to do. It may seem like a ridiculous idea. Encourage anyway. Just be a support and encouragement to that kind of leadership. Respond to it. It really does empower a guy to know, hey, you know what? When I tried to take that step, I said we're going to read the whole Bible in a week or whatever step he's wanting to take. You may know it's unrealistic, but encourage, hey, I'm so glad you're taking this step, or that you've said, you know, we ought to sign up for kids ministry or whatever step might be taken. Just encourage that.
This is maybe an unpopular question, but I'm just curious about it. What does it mean when it says the wife is the weaker vessel?
Okay, so 1 Peter, this verse that talks about husbands, you're to be gentle with your wives, because they are co-heirs with you of the gracious gift of God, and they are the weaker vessel. Maybe I'll give you the unpopular answer. So I think there's a couple dimensions to it. One, I think certainly there's truth in that physically. I mean, by and large, most of us know that's true. I think there's also something to that emotionally as well. Women are more influenced by their emotions than men are. It's not that they have less intellect than we do, but there are certain, you factor in decision making, and emotions play a much larger role often for women than for men. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. The point of that verse, however, is not talking about, you know, we ought to see our wives as weaker vessels, but that we ought to treat them in a particular way because we understand this. Treat them gently as husbands. Does that help?
Yeah. Haley, I just wanted to get your take on the four pictures of oneness for people who are dating.
Yeah.
What would you say other than intimacy is good face-to-face contact? Like you said, before you touch your body, touch your heart and mind.
Yeah.
What if you've already touched your heart and mind?
Okay. Then you should get married. Well, you know what? I mean, I think here's the thing. Around this stuff, this is what I see. Now, I'm kind of an old guy with regard to this stuff. Pretty traditional around these things. But I think in our day, there's far too much of the physical intimacy, not just sex-wise, but even things that couples do together that I think used to be the exclusive right of married couples. So couples that travel together. To me, it takes out all the surprise, the enjoyment of those first things when you actually get married. So some couples, what they want to do is they want to kind of achieve all the things that married couples get to do except the sex. And I think intimacy is far bigger than that. And you are building those bonds anyway. And I would say if you're heading down that road already, well, you know, speed up the process and get married. So I'm not saying, I mean, you know, certainly there's romance and there's things that need to take place that should take place in your relationship. But intimacy before marriage can only go so far in my mind.
Lee, can I add someone to that?
Yeah.
I would say, too, going back to the convictions thing, if you're, not to pick on you, but if you're dating a guy who can't take responsibility and can't keep his pants on now, run. Like, it's not going to, like, if he's the kind of guy that your convictions are, let's not do this, this stuff. God saves us for marriage, and he can't keep his pants on. He's a loser. He's still a little boy. He's not ready to be a man. So you just have to really check that. And that's a good challenge for men, too. Like, you can add that.
Yeah, well, you know what? Okay, let me... Yeah, I would agree with you. Here's what I'd say. My experience of working with couples, young couples in particular, I have the distinction in our church. I can give you four couples where I have told the girl, you know what, you need to break up with this guy, simply because he's taking too long to ask you to marry him. It's kind of this thing drags on and on and on, and in all of those instances, they got married, because after about a week of being without her, he's realized, like, what am I, an idiot? And so when you kind of, you know, try and drag this thing out and say, well, I don't want to get married yet, I just want to have all the benefits of marriage, you need to grow up. Absolutely. So, yeah, I sometimes get to do that. And all of those guys, I think they would all thank me that that is what happened in their relationship, because eventually they got married and they said, I need to take responsibility here for this relationship. So I'm not saying shotgun wedding or anything, but, so I don't know. Hopefully that helps answer that question.
I just mean, like, for the guy who says he's a Christian. He's
yes.
Jesus,
yeah.
Him,
yeah.
And he can't keep his pants on. He's still
yeah.
a boy.
Yeah. Yes, specifically related to that issue, if that's kind of the deal, then, yeah, I think you need to say, I kind of had enough of this type of relationship. Not that people don't fail and there's repentance involved. That's very, very different situation, right? Anyone else? Anything else before we go? Okay, it's been fun for me to come and do this for you guys. I want you to know, I mean, you guys are from Westside. I love to hear what's happening at your church. I pray for your church. I think it's fantastic that it started, what is it, 5 years now? Great to hear the things that are going on there. And good to see a couple of you guys that used to be my college kids. It's I feel like I'm getting really old. So thanks for letting me do this.